Welcome back to another episode of the LionZeal Show. This is the show for SEOs and digital marketers that like to get nerdy, technical, and discuss the real strategies entrepreneurs are using to grow their businesses. I'm your host, Daryl Rossler, and today I'm joined by Jonathan Kickbush. So first and first, man, thank you for joining me today. It's awesome to have you back on the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It has been a long time. Actually, when you invited me back, I almost had like one of those flashback moments of going, wow, what all has happened since we last caught up? It's insane.
Yeah, so I don't remember exactly when we last spoke. I messaged you a date. Was it like late 2016, I think, right?
I think so, yeah. I think that's right. I might really want to know. But yeah, I think it was about 2016.
So that's a long time ago. In fact, back then, I don't think we knew each other, right? I think that was the first kind of interaction together beyond maybe a brief chat before that.
100%. Yeah, it was one of those, like, I was one of the people that was publishing content in your Facebook group. We also were a pretty prominent vendor at that point. And I think, you know, you were just doing the show, and then I convinced a bunch of people to rep me on a post or something, being like, hey, you need to interview John. And then, you know, the rest is history. But yeah, man, that's wild. That's like 4 years. That's a lot has changed. Back then we were PBN Butler. Now we're SEO Butler. Yeah. Just think about it that way, like a whole brand change.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. Yeah, I just checked it. It's October 2016, so a long time ago. Wow. So for anyone, just in case, for the one person listening that's like, who is this guy? Do you want to like introduce yourself again?
Sure. So as you said, and very well pronounced, my name is Jonathan Kickbush. I am the founder of a brand that's now known as SEO Butler, as well as a couple of other businesses. I am, we're basically a productized service vendor for the marketing industry, providing all sorts of services. And then, you know, I do a bunch of other stuff. I'm sure we're going to dive into it over time.
Awesome, man. Yeah. Gosh, there's so much to start with, especially I'm trying to think of what we talked about in that original interview, but it's completely clear in my mind. It's just way too long ago. But let's kind of start a little bit kind of with the services. So what services are you guys offering today?
That's a really good question. It's kind of funny because, you know, the first one that we spoke would have been PBN Butler, right? And back then it would have been really low quality, high volume services at ridiculously low prices. And now we do almost like the opposite apart from the prices. So it's like ridiculously high quality, much lower volumes, and the prices are still really competitive. So now we do content, link building, citations, and social signals. And we've invested so much since we last spoke. So, you know, there came this like pivotal moment after I had bought out my business partner, who I would assume was probably still with us at the time we did this, the last interview. I bought out
I
my
think
business
so. Partner. Yeah.
Yeah. I bought him out and I was like, okay, screw it. If the company's going through such a big change, let's change everything. Right. So we paid an arm and a leg and we got SEOButler.com, which was awesome. And we're like, if we're going to get this, let's do things a little bit, in loss for a better word, a little bit more white hat. And what I mean by that is just simply higher quality services that have a longer lifespan, that are a bit more evergreen. Because back then we were doing like citations with 50,000 GSA links to them and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like just offering all the crazy stuff. And so since then we've built our own order management system. We've hired full-time editors in the UK and in the US. We have writers in the UK and the US, which we didn't back then. You know, all of our writers were in the Philippines. We have a physical office in the UK. Like, we've gone through so much change as a brand. It's really crazy. But yeah, the core products are content, link building, citations, and social signals.
Interesting. In fact, that's super fascinating to me, that transition to quality, or higher quality, should I say. Was it kind of terrifying, to be blunt, making that transition all at once? And then also, I presume, because you had to increase the price and everything to go with that, you have to change out team members and all sorts, right?
100%, man. It was mortifying. And at the beginning, we kind of tried to straddle it both. So like, we first introduced the high quality content. And so we made like this distinction between like PBN quality content and then like professional content. And eventually we just got to a point where we're like, if we want to do this right, we have to just take the plunge. And, you know, we did it. And then, as it so happens to be in life, we did it right, and we got the payoff, which is that people's, like, the retention rate of our customers went up, the average order value went up. And what was funny too was that for a really long time, we made this really big mistake of really undervaluing the content that we were writing, for example. And so we tried to still be so low in the pricing that we would still be somewhat competitive with some of the super cheap options that are on the market. And wow. And I think that was what was really biting us in the ass. And so eventually we're like, no, you know, we want to be able to have the budget to have full-time editors that don't write, that just literally work on quality control. And the only way that we can achieve that is by raising our prices. And we did it. And then we immediately got rewarded again, because we almost slipped into another category of vendor, if that makes sense. And so, you know, and then you started seeing this trend where it started to snowball. And, you know, you'll be able to appreciate this because you've been in the similar and same circles as we have for a long time. And when we first started, there were only maybe a handful of vendors that were swimming in those waters, right? And then, and then you had some pop up, and you had, you know, PBN Butler, and you had Web2 Ranker, and you had, I'm just trying to think. I think there was one called like Ads 30 or something like that. And like maybe a couple of others. Oh, you had Matt's link building service and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, around the same time as we rebranded to SEO Butler, there was just massive explosion of vendors popping up. Like, it was insane, man. You know, just content vendors, citation vendors, link vendors, left, right, and center. But what was funny is that as quickly as they were appearing, they were dropping like flies as well. Because I think what a lot of people struggle with in our industry is that, like, the quality control and the customer service. And that was one thing that I always felt that we had down. And so I feel like that's one of the reasons why we even survived this long.
Yeah, in fact, if I think about what most people say when recommending and promoting you guys and talking about you guys, it's almost always that the customer service and everything is so great. That's usually the thing that comes up.
Right, and that's the thing. Like, we might not beat everyone on price, but the reality is that you end up paying the same amount with some other vendors just simply because of, you know, the bad services, things getting delayed, etc. And I'm not saying that all the other vendors are bad. By no means, there's some great vendors out there. But that's just one of the things that we've really focused on, is the quality of the product, and then the quality of the customer service. Because that's something that I just get so upset about, is when you go out to a restaurant or something and you get bad service, that I really make it my mission to provide our customers with good service.
Yeah, 100% with that. I'm curious what the impact was on kind of the team you're running. I presume you had to get rid of some people, hire new people and whatnot, because you said you went from kind of high volume to lower volume as you changed that quality level. Was there a massive change in that?
Yeah, and it was really heartbreaking, to be honest with you, because one of the realizations that we had is, at the time, you know, I'm trying to think back, like maybe 2015 or something, we went out to India and we opened an office, right? And so we opened an office. We had some really great people working there, especially on like PBN builds and on order management and all of that kind of stuff. And they were doing a really great job, but there were two problems. The first one was that we opened the office in the wrong part of India. And what I mean by that is that we opened it in a city that we were extremely passionate about, just because I'd already lived there in the past. We had loads of friends there. It was easy to get set up. But the city, which is a city in the south, is just not a tech city, right? And so the whole talent pool in the IT sector just moves away. Like, if you're good at IT, you go up north, you work in, you know, Bangalore, Hyderabad, Delhi, Bombay, etc., because the salaries are so much better. And we were in, like, to put it into British terms, we were in like, actually, that's not a good example at all, because Brighton's really creative and technical. but we were in like the holiday town, right? So that was our first mistake. And then the second mistake was that we were straddling trying to be where we wanted to be. So in India and in Europe and in America, as well as skilling up those people that we were able to hire in Pondy, which proved to be really, really hard, because we noticed the quality drop as soon as we would leave and going to other places, right? And so one of the most heartbreaking things about making that change is that eventually we came to the conclusion that we would have to open an office in Europe, because the quality would go up and also the consistency would go up, and that we would have to close the Indian office. And so a couple of years ago now, we made that decision and we pulled the plug. And, you know, we obviously looked after everyone that worked for us in India really, really well. But we made that decision. We started the office here in the UK and never looked back. And, you know, the quality and consistency increases that we've seen were significant. Now, this isn't necessarily a reflection on India or Indian labor whatsoever. It's more a reflection on how we mismanaged the resources that we had, and then the lessons that we learned from that.
I agree with that. So what are the lessons you learned from that for anyone listening?
So the main thing was that it is incredibly hard to skill up someone that has, that is, I'm trying to find the right words. I'm trying to choose them very carefully, but that has a lack of cultural experience when it comes to dealing with another culture. And what I mean by that is that all of our customers are, not all, but like 90% of our customers are US and UK, and US, UK, Canada, Australia, right? So sort of Western English markets. And when in the south of India, a lot of people are still growing up very traditionally, and so they're not ingrained in the culture that we deal with. So they don't necessarily grow up with a computer and, like, you know, and building stuff and, you know, watching stuff on YouTube and like having that mentality that kids grow up with here, where they're playing games and then they're going on YouTube to try and figure out how to beat the game and all of that. So from day one that you hire this person, they're behind the apprentice level person that you would hire back home, right?
And sure. Yeah.
And what we learned is that you would be able to skill them up quite quickly if you were there to really mentor them and invest a lot of time into them, because they're really smart people. Like, I'm not trying to degrade them. They're amazing people. But the problem is we didn't have the time to invest because, you know, we were bringing them into a highly running operation that really needed a push to be able to fulfill everything on time, etc. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that we should have just chosen to not open our office in the south, right? Like, not in that particular city. If we had gone into one of the metro cities, we would have spent a little bit more money, but we would have gotten people that had a couple of years of experience in the field that we would have been able to skill up to the level that we wanted them at very, very quickly. And so we just lost so much time by trying to bring these people up to speed. And that was really just a huge, huge learning curve.
That makes a lot of sense. Does that translate into other positions? For example, if you're hiring a writer, do you hire someone that has a lot of writing experience? Do you hire someone that it tends to be sort of interested in that sort of creative type thing. What do you look at when you're hiring for those different positions?
Absolutely. Like that is actually such a great question. Something I'm really, really passionate about because I think that a lot of people get it wrong. We hire writers, then we teach them the SEO side of things. So we predominantly hire people that have a journalism background, a professional writing background, English literature background, any of those kind of things. You know, for the longest time, we had a very close partnership with one of the Florida universities in order to get talent directly out of the master's programs and be able to offer them experience and, you know, and obviously be getting paid, but offering them real world experience while they're still working on their master's or their PhD. And it worked amazingly. Nowadays, we get most of our referrals from writers and from advertising if we need to do a push. But initially, you know, we also made some of the mistakes where we looked at, you know, hiring people that were SEO aware and then trying to get them to create content. And that really didn't work out very well for us because I believe that, and this sounds really simple and almost pedantic, but like, I really want writers to be able to be writers and to think creatively and just create content and then let the SEO people go in and make the tweaks and adjust the headings and, you know, look at the densities. And obviously, yeah, you know, you have to make sure your writers aren't keyword stuffing and plagiarizing and all of that stuff, but those are fundamentals. But I don't necessarily want my writer to become a machine. I want them to become like a creative flower that's creating all this beautiful stuff that people are actually interested in reading, because otherwise we end up with this problem where we end up with a bunch of content that ranks really well but doesn't make anyone any money.
Sure. No, that makes a lot of sense to me. And on the topic of writers, actually, because they're interested in writing, because they have a background in writing, does that mean they're less likely to get kind of that burnout, basically what it is, right? Because a lot of writers, I found in my own experience as well, after just throwing them article after article after article to write, they get pretty burnt out fairly soon.
Sure. And that's kind of one of the other things where I would edge on caution, especially for, like, you know, affiliates and marketing agencies and stuff like that are trying to scale their content, is I dare you to try and do anything creative for 8 hours a day and be efficient. it's just not going to happen, right? Like, it's just, it doesn't work that way. Like, I hardly have the motivation to get out of bed some days, let alone be able to sit there and crank out, you know, whatever 1,000 words. So we play a numbers game. We have a really large pool of writers. We have a few that are on staff, but we also have a lot of contracted writers. And we distribute orders and we split them up if we have to, right? And then that's where our editors come in and our content managers to make sure that everything stays consistent. So, like, we work with about 70 writers in the UK and the US together, and that is how we're able to fulfill great volumes. But none of those writers write more than, say, 10,000 words a week, and many of them only take on 3,000 words a week or 5,000 words a week, right? Because you know, they want to be able to stay creative. And a lot of them as well, and this is the other great thing for us, a lot of them are doing this as a side thing to either a main job, education, or something else, right? So we've had everything. We've had people while going through university. We've had amazing women doing it during pregnancy, where they're like, well, I've got to be home for the next couple months. I'm going to be, you know, why not crank out some content? I'm going to be sat on the couch anyway. Honestly, we've had everything. We've had people then graduate school, getting amazing jobs, but asking us if they can stay on because they enjoyed writing so much and they're not going to be able to do it in their new job. And so it's like, we have this huge, huge, group of people that are creating content at different times and for different reasons. And so it works out really well because we always tend to get them at their freshest.
No, that is awesome. I like that. And I think that's hugely important. I mean, you're totally right from my own perspective. If I'm trying to do anything creative, even just like record videos or interviews. One time I did like 10 of these interviews in like 3 days, and I was so burnt out by the last interview. I could like barely remember who I was talking to. it was really bad. Cause it just completely fries you. So I'd imagine, I haven't thankfully had to do that, trying to write like 30, 50,000 words of content or something crazy a week would be just absolutely nuts and impossible to really think properly.
Yeah. And that's where, like, look, if you have to have writers on staff, right? And that's just like, it's how your business functions or is whatever, then what I would really recommend is that you teach them how to do content planning. And so that way they get to be creative when they're writing, but you also get them to help you out by planning content so that you don't have to waste loads of time creating content scopes and plans and keyword research and all of that jazz.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reality is that the writer is most of the time the most educated person on it anyway, right? Because if they've already, like, let's say that you have, I don't know, a teapot affiliate website. This writer has created 10,000 words about teapots. They've researched that and they understand the teapot inside out. Who's it going to be easier for to think of new topics to create? It's always going to be the writer. And so instead of having them work on a crap load of stuff every single day, writing from end to end, just have them do some planning and then have them do some writing, which really, really, really helps. And the other thing that we learned that I just remembered that works really well for people that have writers on salaried positions is we cut the hours of our full-time writers without cutting their pay and found them to be more productive. So we cut the day by an hour, but like with the understanding that they would have to try and get as much done as they were before in that hour less, in the 7 hours that they then had instead of eight. And they can start whenever they want. So they can come in, I'm usually in the office ridiculously early. So they can come in whenever they want. And then, you know, if they start at 8, that means they get to finish at 3 p.m., right? And, but we're still paying them for the full day. And as soon as we did that, man, productivity went up, which is insane. But just the mentality shift of I have to get this done in this time and then I still have my afternoon, game changer. I'm sure that there's some crazy cool science behind it. I wouldn't know, but it works.
No, it makes sense to me, especially if they know they have that time, they can make plans and effort in the afternoon, then it's even more motivation. Hey, let's get this done so I can go do my thing.
Exactly.
What about SEO? So we talked a lot about writers. One of the big difficulties or objections people have when they're growing out their agency or affiliate business is they're the SEO. They're the one that does all the SEO work. They're the one that plans out everything for the campaigns. So how do they then hire someone to help them out with that? Or do they hire like a full-on SEO? Do they hire someone and train them up? Do they hire someone for just on page? What is your advice on that? And what is it you guys do?
Sure. So that's a really interesting question and something that I'm not sure if I have the right answer on yet. But I think that we have an agency as well where we do SEO for people. And one of the things that I've always struggled with is the finding the balance of who to hire when in an SEO agency. Because as you know, it's extremely difficult to hire really competent SEO people that really understand everything that you do and how you want it to be done, because like there's a million different ways and methodologies and ways to do it basically. So the solution that I've found so far is that initially what I believe people should do is hire someone that's fairly junior, that's fairly inexperienced, that's affordable, that ideally they can work with very closely. And my goal for that person would be to learn individual aspects of the overall process rather than understanding the overall process. And what I mean by that is it is going to be a huge financial and time investment to try and teach somebody everything and how you want it to be done. So what I'm thinking is, teach them how to do some of the things that are taking most of your time, right? So teach them keyword research, or teach them rewriting meta descriptions or uploading them, or whatever it might be that's eating up a ton of your time. Teach them those individual bits and pieces first, just to buy back your time. Because if that person costs you, let's say, $8 an hour, and your time costs you, let's say, $20 an hour, that's what you value it as, then that's already you making $12 an hour back just by them doing that. Over time, you then start filling in the gaps in between those building blocks and you skill them up. That is the one solution that I found, is you find someone with foundational knowledge, good computer knowledge, you know, they know how to touch type, all of that jazz, and you just skill them up for the basics. The other approach that I found, and this is the approach that we took, is that you hire a few of those people, but you also hire an incredibly skilled, probably very expensive, senior strategist, somebody that can then pull all of the strings so that you can kind of remove yourself from that position. But what I will say is, you're not going to find that person for like $2,000 a month or something like that. Because if they're really at that level, then they're also going to be capable of doing their own thing. And so they, you know, the only person you're going to find is a person that wants that security, that wants to not have to deal with account management and sales and all of that kind of stuff, but you're going to have to pay them properly. And so then you have them sit over the whole process. They take on the strategy side of things when you get a new client or a new project or a new site or whatever, and they then instruct the junior people that you're training up on an individual task how and when to do those.
That is super interesting. And that makes sense to me. I think the first approach probably makes the most sense for most people if they're still building up and still don't have the highest level of cash flow yet. But the second approach makes a lot of sense also, especially for later, which you can kind of transition over to that in the future.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of the thing too, is like, the longer you're in the business, or the industry or whatever you want to call it, you're not going to find that senior person overnight. Like that's the definitely reality. And one of the other things that I've learned, and this is kind of a luxury, but when you get to a point, it really pays to throw money at seeing, I'm trying to find the right words here, to seeing where people's skill levels are at and how they think. So a great example of that is link building, right? Like, link building is something that usually is really easy when somebody starts looking at a new way of doing things, and then everybody does it and it becomes harder again, right? So that's what we saw with PBN domains, like way back in the day. Like, it was super easy. We were scraping them every day with like Python bots and Scrapebox and stuff, and then going into Facebook groups and selling domains for hundreds of dollars off of the back of like an Excel sheet and not even owning the domain. And then everybody started scraping, and you started having people buying like Nominate databases and stuff like that, and it became harder. So then people were selling links on PBNs, and then that became harder because everybody was doing it and the prices were being driven down and the quality went kind of sideways and all of that. And then the whole guest post thing started. So the point that I'm actually trying to get to is, when we're trying to solve a problem like that, we run our own tests, but at the same time, we'll go out to people that we think could be subject matter experts in these things, and we will throw money at them to run campaigns for us so we can learn from it, right? So we'll say, oh, okay, there's somebody that's an expert at, I don't know what, guest post link building, for example, and they have this one specific way that they do it. Right, okay, cool, let's see if it's actually true. Instead of trying to, you know, reverse engineer or anything like that, we'll just pay them the money, see if it's any good, and if it is good, then we might see if we can hire them or get them to teach us, create materials, whatever. And so what we learned over time is that when we're starting and when we were bootstrapping, we couldn't afford that. But now we're kind of in a position where we're actually able to throw money at those kind of problems and figure them out much, much quicker. And that's been a really, really rewarding feeling, being able to do that.
I think that is a massive difference between people that are at what we call like a higher level and people that are kind of starting out. Now, like you said, I think in most cases, you genuinely don't have the money to pay someone to give you any advice or anything like that. But I see that distinction in people when it comes to courses, when it comes to seminars, when it comes to conferences, whatever, that there are certain people that are usually doing pretty well, not always, but when you look at the people that are doing really well, in most cases, they're super happy to invest money. They'll pay a coach. They'll like you said, find someone that's really good at something and offer them money to help them out. And they're constantly investing in learning, whereas on the opposite side, you get some people that, again, maybe they don't have the money, which is a pretty good reason not to, but if they do have the money, they are terrified of spending it. And it is totally not spending when you're putting that into learning. It may not pay back immediately, but given enough time, in most cases, presuming you're learning from the right person, it pretty much always does.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think to add to what you just said, the other thing is, people don't value asking for help. And I don't understand that. It blows my freaking mind, man. Like you, so people seem to have this mentality that other people that are doing well never need help. And that is the biggest fallacy ever. The amount of people that I have reached out over time and just said, look, is there any way I could get an hour of your time? I can see that you're a Facebook marketing expert. Can you hook me up with an hour of your time? I would really like to bounce some ideas off you, right? Man,
it's awesome.
It's so easy. And you're either going to get it for free or you're going to get it for a reasonable amount of money 9 times out of 10. And now when I say a reasonable amount of money, you may have to drop a couple of hundred bucks. But here's how I look at it. If that person's been doing, let's just keep using this example, Facebook ads for 5 years for e-com stores, and I'm trying to run Facebook ads for my e-com store, I can purchase 5 years worth of experience with a couple of $100 and record the call and watch it back as many times as I want and take notes. And not once, when I've then sent some follow-up questions, has someone said, oh, mate, you're going to have to pay me again or have another call or whatever. You know, man, it is the biggest value drop or whatever you want to call it ever to just tap into people's knowledge.
Yeah, that is huge. I 100% agree with that. Let's talk about team culture. I know you're kind of big on this stuff. I remember it must be a few years back now, you kind of talked about this at Chiang Mai at that conference. I don't know what to start because I'm not super experienced in that. So what are your thoughts kind of on this and what is your philosophy on it? Because I know it's pretty interesting.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm really pleased that you remember that was one of the things I was talking about. You know, for me, I've been trying to study a couple of things now for a few years, and it's becoming somewhat of an obsession, which is I'm trying to study infinite game theory and empathy. And what I'm learning over time by following different people and reading books and stuff like that is that there is and this is going to seem really commonsensical, by the way, but that there's a direct correlation between the happiness of your team and how stressless they are and the return that your business brings in. And that seems really logical, but sadly, we're still not seeing that in the workplace across the majority of businesses, right? Because the way that the majority of entrepreneurs and founders and business owners, et cetera, see themselves is that they have to protect the interests of the shareholders and the clients, and then the staff basically comes last, right? And what I learned is that you kind of want to turn that around, and you want to start looking at the founder being almost like, quote unquote, a servant to the staff making sure that the staff is working at their optimal performance through happiness and stresslessness and all of that, and that the staff or the team will then look after the customers or the clients. And, you know, and that comes in from a couple of different aspects. And so what I learned over time is that money is one of the most foundational aspects of it that plays a role to a certain extent. And what I mean by that is that paying people a good living wage has a huge impact. Beyond that, it doesn't have a huge impact. And below that, it does have a big impact. So if you're paying people a crap wage, they don't perform well. If you're paying people a great wage that is fair and means that they can live without major worries, they can have some savings, they're good, basically, they are working at a much higher rate. When you then go into ridiculous pay, where you're overpaying someone dramatically, it doesn't increase that graph significantly. Which is crazy, because you would think so, but money is just not that big of a motivator, right? So that's where it's kind of one of the foundations. The second thing that is probably far bigger is happiness. And happiness comes in from a couple of different aspects. It comes in with the feeling of importance, the feeling of fulfilledness. Being able to feel like what you're doing matters, that it's not just, you know, a throwaway task and you have to do it over and over and you're just a cog in the machine. And then, you know, culture within the team, no matter if it's within an office or if it's outside, if it's remote, but feeling like you belong to something. And when you put all of these different aspects together, what you'll find is that you can very efficiently orchestrate an environment where people are happy to work and they don't feel stressed by, you know, bills and stuff like that, and they feel like they matter in the overall vision that your business has. And man, it's a beautiful thing. It all comes together very, very well.
I love it. That's really cool. I'm a big fan of kind of reading books and stuff on that sort of topic also. And also not even on the topic of your team's happiness, but those same things apply on a personal level. It's the exact same thing, right? If you're trying to be happier and more fulfilled in your own life, it's the exact same thing you need to do.
100%. Yeah. No, like if you're worried about how you're going to be able to pay your rent and stuff like that, that is a motivator to a certain extent, but also only for certain personality types, right? So like someone like myself, yeah. I thrive in adversity just because I'm really, really eager, and I'm the kind of person that will work extra hours when he doesn't have to and all that. But for the majority of people, it doesn't. For the majority of people, it's a depressant and they will not perform better with that. So just knowing that, you know, you've got money in your savings, you can go on your holiday, you can pay your rent and all of that kind of stuff is a huge, huge motivator and keeps you stressless or less stressed even.
Yeah, for sure. In fact, I see it sometimes when people will message me and they say, I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to do this. And they're brand new. They aren't making any money yet. They have no clients. So I'm going to quit my job and go at this full time right now. And it absolutely terrifies me because, like you said, I don't think it's the right approach for most people. Most people are not going to respond well to having zero income and losing money every single month with all that stress added up. It can work, and obviously some people make it work, but I think it's a little bit too risky unnecessarily because you can build it up on the side anyway. And like you said, I don't think most people are going to respond well to that stress, and it's just going to make it a lot worse for them.
I agree. And I think that, you know, when you then look at some of the reasons why they think they should quit their job, and, you know, there are a lot of people that advocate for that, right? There's a lot of people that advocate for, like, just, you know, go jump in both feet first and, you know, you're going to make it happen and all of that. But one of the big reasons is that people say that they don't have enough time. And I think that anybody that's saying that to themselves is probably lying to themselves, because, you know, the reality is that pretty much all of us find that we have, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours in a day that we have time to watch TV or do other things. And so, look, there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, you might change your hours to accommodate your side hustle better, but I don't think that you should risk it all right away. And I mean, that's not how I started this business. Our first hire wasn't ourselves. Our first hire in this business was a customer order and support manager, so that we could continue to do our day jobs while the business was growing until it could support us, right? Like, and I think that's just the way that it should be. It's kind of the other advantage of doing it that way is that you're starting the business in a way that you can run it with you needing to put in minimal hours. And if your goal is to one day get to the point where it can pay your bills and you're working minimal hours, which, let's be honest, a lot of people do want, then what is your excuse? Why do you need to quit your day job? Quit your day job when you're making the money and you can afford to just work the 2-3 hours in your side hustle.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Here's something interesting. I know a lot of people struggle with making that first hire, but I also see quite a lot of people kind of do the opposite to that, actually. And I think they move a little bit too fast with hiring too many people too quickly. Do you have any experience or thoughts on that topic? Of like just moving too quickly, hiring too many people too fast?
Yes. So this is another learning experience that we made ourselves. You know, we overcommitted right away by hiring people on and, you know, growing the team and stuff like that. And so we learned that the hard way. And when you assess the revenues and the turnover and the profits of the majority of digital businesses, what you'll find is that labor costs are the highest costs in their business, right? So, you know, unless maybe you're doing something crazy where you're spending insane amounts on, I don't know, some sort of link building, whatever. But the majority of people, labor is the most expensive part of their business. And so one of the things that I always recommend is to, before hiring somebody else, to first test it out by hiring a contractor to do that role, to then see if you actually have enough to give that person to warrant a full-time hire. That could potentially cost you a little bit more because contractors tend to cost more than salaried people. But on the one hand, it will mean that if you try it for 6 weeks, and then after 6 weeks, you're like, actually, you know what? We only have part-time work for this person. Let's hire someone part-time. Great. Or it might turn out that that contractor's amazing and you can convince them to come on full-time. All sorts of stuff. But I think that especially in the US and UK, where, you know, you might have to give people a permanent contract and stuff like that. It's all very expensive. The whole, you know, the whole paperwork aspect of it. I'd approach it with caution personally and then scale as you really need to.
That makes sense. Here's something for me that's kind of changed probably since the last time we did the interview. And that is kind of my thoughts on like hiring and that sort of thing. So these days, I usually recommend people to outsource versus hire in most cases if they can. For example, if they are going down the route of launching affiliate sites or anything like that and need loads of content, in most cases, I'd say, hey, go to SEO Butler, buy the content rather than trying to hire contractors, and definitely rather than trying to hire full-time team members. That's a good plug of you guys, but the reason I recommend it is because at least most of the people I'm talking to are super lifestyle oriented. They want to build a lifestyle business and they want to have freedom and they want to have more time to scale anyway. So it's actually good for business also. So by outsourcing that way, and in terms of links and everything that way, SEO is really easy to outsource. And doing so gives you so much more freedom in terms of personal time, but also in terms of just growing your business because you're not managing people and everything that comes with that.
100%. Yeah. And I unequivocally agree with that. The only role in that particular scenario that I would then recommend that you bring on board in the long term, once you can, you know, once you've scaled to that point, would be like a project manager, somebody that can place orders for you and keep everything on track, chase up suppliers, those kind of things. But other than that, I couldn't agree more with you. The main reason why people tend to move away from that is because they want to save on costs and they don't see all of the hidden costs with hiring people full time.
That's pretty much when I started SEO. I used to do it that way. Then I switched to VAs because why am I paying for this when I can get VA so much cheaper to run the whole thing for me? So I had an army of VAs. And then I realized actually I'm spending quite a lot of money, but also so much time managing these VAs that it absolutely wasn't worth it.
Yep, I totally get that. Yeah. No, I mean, look, this is something I always say. People ask me about about SEO Bubble and the agency and stuff and doing everything really properly and in-house and all of that. We chose the most punishing route to do this. There is absolutely no argument about it. I am no longer as flexible as I once were because I have a physical office. I have to pay office leases. I have to do all of this. But the payoff for us is we get the big corporate clients, we can show them around and those kind of things, right? So for us, it has paid off, but it also comes with a lot of downside.
Sure. So it totally depends on what your goals are and what you're looking to achieve, right?
Exactly. And if your desire is the lifestyle aspect of it, then I wouldn't recommend to go this route. Absolutely.
That makes sense. What is your personal role within the company today? What are you working on?
So that's an awesome question. I've really changed my position over time because when we last talked, we really, for the most part, just had PBN Butler and we had a couple of small agency clients. And, now we have SEO Butler, which is doing really well, which is its own brand, really. We have the agency, which is doing really well. We have another business that does investments into digital properties. And then I also have a consultancy that I started with a good friend who you're probably very familiar with, Jared, where we consult businesses on digital marketing. And so, and we have a SaaS business now that I think about it. And so my role has become much, much more top level. I spend a lot of my time in meetings and working on strategy and having sort of executive meetings and director meetings and stuff like that with the various, key holders of the or key decision makers of the different businesses and brands. And then I still do a lot of sales, I will admit. And the reason for that is that I absolutely love it. I don't write the proposals or do any of the actual SEO work, but I do a lot of the sales for the agency because I get such a kick out of it.
That is awesome, man. Was it difficult to make that transition to the higher level stuff versus kind of being involved in a lot?
Personally, yes, because I'm a personality type that really likes to be in control. And so it was really petrifying for me to let go of some of those responsibilities and some of that I'm still working on, right? One of the things that really helped with that was my wife, who cusses me out and is like, why are you trying to micromanage all of these things? Just let this person do it or let that person do it. They're perfectly fine to do it. But as we're growing and as we're learning, I'm definitely getting better at it. And the other thing is that you end up getting to a point where your time constraints force you into that mentality of being able to delegate, which is really, really good. And so, I now really love it. I really love that sort of fast paced, you have three calls back to back and they're for three different businesses working on three different projects. That's exciting.
Yeah, that is really awesome. That's so cool, man. Let's rewind quite a lot because I think you have a pretty interesting background as well prior to getting into SEO. I remember seeing your Fiverr film where you used to You were the breakup guy, right? And then you also run a security company, was it, at some point? Like, can you talk a little bit about your background pre-SEO?
Sure. Let me try and think, where do we want to start? So one of the first things that I hide extremely well, except for in my name, is I'm German, right? So I grew up in Berlin. I was so shocked
when I heard this, because your accent, it didn't make sense. You have a more British accent than I do.
I have no idea where that comes from. But I grew up, you know, my mom is a massive hippie, and I didn't really grow up around tech. Like, I didn't have a Nintendo 64 or a computer at home or anything until I was much older. And I eventually got my introduction into tech when I was 16 and I moved to India and I learned web development. But this was in the early, in the middle ages, I would say, for web development. So it was all Flash websites, like those horrendous, horrible sites.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
and so spent a bunch of time in India. That's when I fell in love with it. I came back, you know, and I was still really young. And so obviously living at mom's wasn't really an option. And I got headhunted by a company called Human Factors, who are an authority on like usable design and user experience and like engineering, like persuasive designs that help people engage with technology. And they were doing this at like a huge level. I'm not talking like a cute little CRO project on a website. Like, we were, we were engineering like where to put buttons in like airplane cockpits, or how to design ATM machines so that they're more intuitive and stuff like that. So like, really cool stuff. And they had hunted me to become an account executive in England, which is when I moved over here. And I made it to director of sales for Europe, which was really exciting. And I had a fantastic time. I mean, I was traveling around Europe, dealing with, you know, huge billion-dollar companies and, you know, doing the whole thing at like 18, 19, going to corporate dinners and wonderful stuff like that. And then the bubble burst, man, quite literally. I mean, the US market crashed 2008. This business had like, I want to say like 8 to 10 offices in the US at that point. And that just sucked the money right out of that business. And I got made redundant, right? So here I am, like 19 or something, having come off of what I, like at that point I was making like £70,000 a year plus bonuses and stuff. And like, you know, for a 19 year old kid that has no professional experience, that's a crap load of money. A lot more than I knew how to spend at that time, at that age. And I just found myself like overqualified and unemployed. And so I needed to figure something else out. And I saw this gap in the market, which was, I looked at the security market in the UK, like the physical security market. And I decided that I was going to create like a boutique security company and kind of look after fancier stuff, because a lot of the security businesses out there were kind of just dealing with like, you know, this sort of like big, ugly guys that are intimidating, that kind of stuff. And so we opened a security
company. By the way, that sort of thing is super interesting to me, how you had absolutely no experience within that niche, that vertical whatsoever, but you researched and you found a gap, then made what is a pretty massive jump into it.
Yeah, no, that was the scary thing. Like, so I got my... So in the UK, you have like licenses, and the licenses are tiered. It might have changed by now, actually. I actually haven't stayed in that field whatsoever. But at the time, there were licenses. So you had different licenses in order to be able to carry out different parts of the security world. So you had like a CCTV license, which would allow you to like sit in a store and look at like cameras, right? You had the door supervisor license, which basically licensed you to do like nightclubs and alcoholic venues and events and festivals and that kind of stuff. And then above that, you had the close protection license, which would basically allow you to do like bodyguarding. And then it came with like a lot of add-ons, like physical intervention and handcuffing and all of that kind of stuff. And so initially I did the door supervisor one, and I joined a couple of companies down here. And that's where I discovered how much I didn't like the that part of the industry, that sort of rough and tough. And so I invested into getting my close protection license. And then I got, and then I set up the business and I started getting really, really cool gigs. Like we did, you know, the Queen's Polo in Windsor. And we wow. had Cadenza as one of our clients, who are like a Swarovski jewelry store. And we looked after foreign billionaires and foreign royalty and all of that kind of cool stuff. And that was all... It was really cool, and it was a fantastic experience. It had a lot of downsides, like the hours were crap. You know, you always had to chase your money. Those kind of big businesses suck at paying, and all of that kind of stuff. But honestly, after 3 years of doing that, I was really burnt out by it. And I started to look for something else. One of the things that happened throughout all of that was that story that you picked up. And basically what happened is I found a British website called Five Squids, and it was some British guy that had made a copy basically of Fiverr, right? And at that time when I discovered it, it was brand new, so there were very few people selling gigs on it. And so everybody was competing with one another to come up with the most ridiculous gig that they would be willing to offer. So there was like a guy that would be like, at that point, your bodyguard and Call of Duty, and he was like a ranked player. There were people offering like a lot of the same stuff that's now very common on Fiverr. Anyway, I wanted to throw my hat in the ring and kind of, you know, compete with some of the more ridiculous stuff. And so I said, I'll break up with your boyfriend or girlfriend for £5 on your behalf. And, you know, the worst part is I actually started getting some gigs, and and I had to do it. And, it went surprisingly well. My conflict resolution skills were okay. But what was funny is that a couple of months into that, a PR agency contacted me and said, look, you know, we've been hired by this website, and the story that we're trying to do is we're trying to do a story of like really crazy gigs that people have come up with to make money as like a side gig. And we chose yours to be one of them. Would you be okay with us pitching this to a couple of news sources just to see if we can get you in there? And I'm like, okay, why not? So they get me an interview with the Associated Press, who say that they can get the story into the Daily Mail. For anybody that doesn't know, the Daily Mail is one of the big trash papers in the UK that has huge readership. And it's like one of those, like, you know, headline magazines. I don't know what you call those, tabloids, I guess. And the Daily Mail does an interview with me. They say, yeah, you know, we're going to put this in the women's section under, like, it's like one of those little side blurb stories. It's like a funny thing that they can hate on, and you're good. They sent a photographer to my house to get a headshot and all of that. And then it just went quiet, man. Like, I didn't hear back from them for like 2 weeks or something. And that's when I learned about news cycles. So, you know, they keep these kind of stories that are not time critical on stocks, that when they have a slow day, they just slide it into the news so that they have enough stories, right? Which as a layman, I had never even thought about. And then I get the phone call and they say, hey, you're gonna be in the Daily Mail and in the Sun tomorrow. And I'm like, okay, cool. So the next morning I waddle down to the corner store that I go down to very frequently to, you know, buy cigarettes or milk or whatever. And I get the newspaper, and as you do, you kind of start flicking through it on the counter because you want to make sure that, you know, it's worth buying, even though it's like 50p or something. And I flick through it and I get to the page and I'm centerfold, double cover. My face wow. is basically in original size, and the headline is, "This is the last man on earth you ever want to get a call from," right? Something along those lines. And there's this huge piece about how I'm this guy and I break up all of these relations. And they obviously spun that story to just become the craziest thing ever, right? So after that, for 2 weeks, my phone wouldn't stop ringing with interview requests. And I did over 50 radio interviews internationally. I was on Wow. This Morning. I was on Sunrise TV, which is the Australian morning TV show. I was on Playboy Radio, which I didn't know existed. it was kind of crazy, you know, it went kind of mental. And it really got my love going for the internet. And I think that was probably one of the triggers for me to try and figure out how I could make more out of my time on the internet. And so that's when I started talking to this guy called Luke, who ended up being my business partner in this venture early on that I then later bought out. And that was really the very earliest start of what was then PDN Dollar.
That again is another massive jump, right? You didn't know SEO or anything at that time.
No, not at all. I honestly, though, for me, it was more about I was very confident in sales and in like people skills, and Luke brought in the tech knowledge. So that made me feel much more comfortable.
Gotcha. How did you meet Luke?
You know what? We spoke about this for like years. We don't know. We think it might've been through like a forum or something.
Interesting. That is actually pretty common these days. I think there's so many people that I know, and even like close personal friends, and so many of them now just met on Facebook or a forum or whatever like that, which is so cool.
Yeah, 100%. Like I would say now that the majority of the people that I speak to frequently, I met online.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool.
You know what I mean?
So how long did it take you from getting a little bit into the industry, starting to learn a little about it, to then launching what became SEO Butler?
So it took us a while. I would say it took us about 6 months to launch the first ever iteration. At that point, we only offered article writing services, and they were like super spammy ones, right? like super low quality, super cheap. And so I kind of learned as we went along, just layering the information as we scaled what we were doing. You know what I mean?
Sure. That makes sense.
So it just kind of like my knowledge grew over time, and then I started to really invest myself. And you know, the thing was, it was easy to do that from a like productized service vendor point of view, much more so than from a than if we had tried to like become an SEO agency or something like that.
Sure.
Because I would never advise to do that without, you know, having like intricate knowledge. And then obviously for me, the really comforting thing was that I always had my business partner who had a lot of SEO experience as well.
What was his reasoning for partnering up with you?
I think he was one of those people that had a lot of the knowledge, but didn't necessarily have the drive to like go out and like, you know, be in the Facebook groups and like hustle for gigs.
Sure.
And stuff like that. He wanted to be more on like the technical side and the implementation side.
I find that super interesting about you, because you're very good at kind of the people side, communication side, sales side. And not to say you're not also very good, and I have a very good understanding of SEO also, but it's fascinating to me because most people think if you're going to run an SEO business, then you've got to be super technical minded and you've got to be like a computer whiz and all that sort of thing, you know?
I think that's a misconception, you know? I mean, I would argue that I have a very good understanding of SEO, but I don't see myself as a technical SEO. You know, we hire fantastic technical SEOs and I learn something from them every day. But for me, what's important is that I understand the business side and I understand how to sell SEO and how to explain it to other people, which arguably a lot of the very technical people never learn how to do. right? And so it really has helped us a lot. Like, our head of SEO never needs to speak with clients, for example, right? Our project managers or myself can do that.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. I actually have quite contradicting thoughts on the topic, because to a degree, I also think you should just play to your strengths. So if you're very, very good at SEO, you don't need to talk to people. You can just focus on SEO. But then in a separate way, for me, it was super beneficial to learn sales and learn how to communicate with people, because it allowed me to kind of land clients and build the business I have today. So it's totally contradicting. I think both kind of work.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from entirely, man. It is really a complex problem.
Yeah, because I get asked that, like, should I, like someone that comes in, they're pretty good at SEO, like, should I learn sales and how to land clients? I mean, if you want clients, sure, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to.
Yeah. No, and that's kind of, but arguably too, that's kind of where the thing comes in that you said earlier, right? Like, if you're really good with people and you're really good at like sales and stuff like that, then you can outsource everything and still have an agency technically. But my argument there would be that if you are a salesperson, then you should educate yourself on what you're selling to make sure that you aren't mis-selling, etc., which then affects your retention, etc.
Yeah, 100%. I've kind of been, people think, because I promote a lot of stuff to beginners, or in many cases I have anyway, people tend to think that I'm promoting that you can just go out there and get clients and know absolutely nothing. That's my point, is that you can start with no experience, learn it, and then go out there and set it. Not like you can just go out there today with absolutely zero knowledge and just like go land clients and it's easy, because it is far from easy. In fact, SEO is a pretty difficult thing to sell when you're starting out, especially.
Yeah, for sure. That's why I always recommend people to start off with like parts of the overall SEO, you know, ecosystem. So starting off with either something like a productized service, or starting off with, you know, just selling stuff like audits, or just, you know, like getting into the flow of it. Because to do everything and be good at it and like, you know, like get results is actually not that easy.
No, it's true. I mean, how many people do you know that are actually good at every part of SEO? Most people have a specialization within SEO. It's not just SEO, within, maybe they're very, very good at outreach link building. Maybe they're very, very good at technical SEO. Even within that, there's like a specialization usually.
Exactly. And like you know, there's literally a guy in our community, and the one thing he focuses on is penalty removal, right? And there's like one person in our community that focuses just on like content creation, making sure that those articles are just right and researched very well and all of that. And so the exact same thing happens in every part of that ecosystem, especially the bit, like when you start off, of course it's normal that you have one person doing everything, but the bigger you get, the more individuals you have that are specialists at different things.
There's also kind of why I'm a fan of outsourcing. It kind of ties back to that. Yep. Is that you can go pay someone that's really good at link building to do the link building. You don't have to be a specialist at that yourself.
Preach it. Yeah, I totally agree. No, I totally agree.
So back to today, what are your goals and things you're working on now? You kind of mentioned what you're working on, but what is it you're trying to achieve right now?
Sure. So one of the things that we're heavily investing in right now is technology. So, you know, we're working on some really big SaaS projects, like very long-term type stuff. So heavily working on that, and really want to make, you know, we haven't actually launched one yet, so we're just investing. So that's one of the goals. The next goal, I would say, is that on the on our, we're buying into affiliate sites and you know, e-com sites and stuff like that. We really want to grow that out and make sure that that is going to keep growing the way that it is. And then on SEO Butler, we're actually working on some really cool updates to the site and that kind of stuff. So as it stands, we're kind of on the right trajectory. I'm just always conscious of making sure that, you know, none of the spinning plates fall down.
Actually, that kind of ties into my question, because my question was going to be, how do you know it's the right time to go launch your SaaS, to go buy new sites, to go launch new sites and do different things to what you're already doing? If someone's out there and they're making, let's say, $300,000 a year from their SEO consulting business / agency, and they want to get into affiliate, how do they know it's the right time?
Wow, man. I mean, really, I don't know if you ever know if it's the right time, but you know, for us, it's whenever we realized that we were generating surplus revenue, and when we also started to realize that we really wanted to that we really wanted to not just rely on like one or two income sources. So what was really important for us is that we start to have these different investment pots where, you know, if we do have a really bad month on SEO Butler, we do have a really bad time in the agency, that we're not reliant on just that, but that, you know, we have got other stuff coming in. So I would always say that, you know, especially for people that are going into the agency world that then want to go into the affiliate world, my argument would simply be, start it as soon as you have the time available with the resources that you already have. So if you have people that can carry out SEO for you, or you have money and you have the right suppliers, start running affiliate projects on the side and just start growing it until they're big enough to where they can have their own team, you know, and then there. Because I think that unless you're just absolutely crushing it and, you know, you have a couple of hundred grand spare to burn, I would never recommend to just buy really expensive, like really well doing affiliate sites and going like, you know, jumping in both feet first.
Sure, that makes sense to me. I agree with that completely. It's at that stage, I think you're absolutely right. The thing that kind of worries me is people are a little bit too early in it. I think that sometimes, like, I don't know, maybe they're making $5,000-$6,000 a month, which I don't think is enough from the client side to then be like, okay, let's go launch some affiliate sites now. Because I just see that as such a pivotal stage to then grow it much further. I think you can quite, I wouldn't say easily, but it's certainly easier to scale from $6,000 a month to $15,000-$20,000 a month than it is from $0 to $6,000 a month. So I think at that stage, it can be a little bit too soon to start doing stuff. But the way you said it, when you're making money, when you have excess, so to speak, I think is a perfect time to learn, okay, let's launch some extra stuff and let's not just rely on my clients.
Yeah. And that's, I think that you hit the nail on the head. Like, you know, you shouldn't divert your attention too soon. Like I really do agree with that. I think that what I was trying to say is that, you know, whatever scale this takes, but I imagine you have your SEO guys, no matter if they're contractors or whatever, and you start noticing that they're running out of things to do because they're just so optimized in how they work. You're not really interested in onboarding a bunch more clients right now because you've got like 20, 30, whatever. You've got plenty of work to do. So, you know, at that point, you're like, well, you know, let's give them a long-term project. And so that's kind of the approach I'm taking with that. But I also totally agree with you. If you're just starting out and you've got, you know, $4,000-$6,000 a month that's coming in, it's way too soon to start looking at doing other things. You should double down and bring that from, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely, man. All right, we're getting pretty close to wrapping this up. I'm curious, the final sort of topic, which is kind of full circles because you already discussed this already, I'd love to discuss what makes customer service great and effective. I know it's something you're a huge believer in. So what are the practical tips that people listening can apply to their agencies, to their service businesses, to improve their own customer service?
Sure. The biggest thing is empathy. So deploying empathy. So and understanding.
How do you define empathy, by the way?
So that is such a good question. So in this context, what I define as empathy is putting yourself into the shoes of the customer and trying to understand what has led them to the the situation that you're dealing with, right? So like a really great example is when you're dealing with productized services, you will occasionally get the person that asks for a refund or doesn't understand something or whatever. And what for a lot of people, like they tend to get quite annoyed with those people, and they're like, you know, why the hell should I refund you? I did everything I said I would and all of that. And, you know, or it's all on the page. Why don't you just read the page? You know, I'm not going to explain it to you again. And empathy is trying to understand what led them into the situation that made them request a refund, or, you know, and empathy would be looking at that person going, well, you know what? They've probably tried 10 content suppliers and they're really fed up of dealing with them. They've probably tried 15 guest post suppliers and they're sick and tired of, you know, guest posts getting delayed and they just want their money back. And understanding that and then being able to actually translate that into communication with them and being sincere is huge. Like actually just being like actually being sorry and actually emailing them being like, you know what? I get it. We have massively failed you here. We said that was going to be done by then and we failed it. And I am so sorry. And I'm glad to refund you. And we're still going to try and get the order right for you because we've let you down. Right. Like that is,
sure. Yeah.
That's kind
it's
of like
huge.
How, yeah. And, but it's simple and it goes a really long way. And the second thing for me in that kind of customer service, especially for productized services, is to understand the simple maths between behind customer lifetime values, which is something that a lot of people still misunderstand. If you place an order on my website for $25 worth of content and it's your first ever order and we mess it up and I don't refund you, you're gone for life. If I turn that situation around and I say, Daryl, look, I'm so sorry. We just messed this up. And you know what? Here's the $25. We're still gonna finish the order. We're still gonna complete it. And I really hope that you're happy with that. By the time that you get that article through, and if the article isn't a dog's dinner, there's actually a chance that you're going to come back and we're going to have a lifetime value with you, which, you know, could be $500, could be $1,000, could be $2,000, whatever. And so that $20 I'm refunding you isn't actually me losing $20 plus whatever the content cost me. It's actually me gaining $500, $1,000, whatever. And so,
sure, yeah.
You know, that's the second thing that's really important. In the agency side, it's communication. That is one of the biggest factors that I try to drill into people. In the SEO community especially, and the same really goes for most digital services, there's a dramatic lack of communication and it's quite depressing really. Imagine being a service business. You know, let's use something that's stereotypically used as an example. Let's say we're a roofer, right? So I'm a roofer. I'm not particularly technical. And, you know, I agree to do SEO with you for whatever the price is. It doesn't matter. And you finally close me and you've convinced me and you explained stuff to me during the proposal process. And I pay your invoice and then you go silent for a month. And then I don't hear back from you for a month. And then you send me a report that's full of stuff I've never heard of. Right? And that is the reality that's the reality for the majority of this damn industry. And I don't get it, right? Like our clients, within the first week of joining, not only do they have an onboarding call, but they get a video explaining to them how their analytics works. A personalized one. Like we make them a video. We sit down and we take the 10 minutes and we explain to them how their analytics report works. And we show it to them and we send it to them and they watch the video and they have that video forever. And we allow them to come onto our project management platform and we involve them in the decision-making steps around their website. And it reduces churn so much you wouldn't know. They still don't understand what the intricacies of technical SEO are. And that's okay, but they understand that you're working on stuff and that's a pretty huge deal. And so communication is one of the biggest customer service things that you can implement in your business. Even if it's just something like calling in every now and then and saying, hey, how are you doing, man? Like, we haven't spoken in a while. Is everything going right in your business? Tell me about it, you know?
Yeah, that is huge. In fact, one of the things I've always done, even since the beginning, was literally just email a client every now and then and just ask them how their business is. And that was so tiny to me, but it just made sense to do because I actually genuinely wanted to make sure I was doing a good job. But when I spoke to other people and found out they weren't doing that, I was totally shocked because the only communication was literally the report every month. And reluctantly, when the client was annoyed or something, they called them up and they had to deal with them. That was it.
that's just wild, isn't it? Like, it's just
crazy.
I think the thing is, though, that one of the things you have to remember is that a lot of people in this industry are petrified. Like
introverted and don't want to talk to people.
Are petrified of talking to people, right? And I think that is really the crux of it. And I think that if you want to be, like, you can definitely make money without ever speaking to anyone. But I think that if you want to have a long-term relationship with another business, I really, really believe that building up the experience to speak with people is going to go a very long way, especially in the US market. The UK is quite introverted, and British people generally are not as keen to speak to people. But in America, especially if you're dealing with bigger businesses, man, those people don't want to mess around with emails and Slack channels and crap like that. They're just like, hey, Daryl, just give me a call, you know? And it's just like, you jump on a call and you get it sorted and you're done and you make money.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned including your clients in a decision-making process. What does that mean?
So what that means is, like, it's really simple things like getting them to approve content that's going to go live on the website, right? And we do that for two reasons. One of them is for liability. But secondly, we also really like them to feel like they're part of making decisions in the SEO campaign, because it means that they're actively registering that we're always working on stuff. You know, even if it is just four blog posts in a month or something, it's really important to us that they know that, because, you know, we kind of have the luxury that we're now working on bigger retainers. We're no longer working on the, you know, $500 retainers we worked on when we first started. But I think it's very important for them to notice that something's going on. And so we use ClickUp as our project management platform, which I highly recommend, by the way. And we just add them onto the ClickUp platform, and they have access to their own project. They can see our conversations about their project, and, you know, we just don't really hide anything. Obviously, we still have, like, communication external to that, but it's really good for them to see that we are working on stuff all the time.
That makes a lot of sense. Here's something that I'm curious about, because what we talked about mostly there was when it's our fault and what to deal with it. What about when it's the client's fault? For example, one of the things I really love is if you're in a restaurant or something like that, and I don't know, you spill your drink or something. In most cases, most restaurants will just completely replace the drink for free because it's insignificant compared to what you're going to spend there and spend in the future. So what happens when a client of an agency is at fault, whatever it is? I don't know, maybe they screwed something up on their own site, or maybe it's not even a mistake so much as they're asking too much or some sort of problem there that is actually on the client side.
Sure. That's an interesting question. And I think, you know, in order to answer that, it's going to have to be it depends. We try to help our clients out as much as possible, no matter, you know, who's at fault or whatever. But we have also learned to put sort of restrictions in place. So, like, we have in our service level agreement that if the client undoes what we've done and we have to go back in, that we'll charge them for it. Now, have we ever had to do that? No. But is it a statement in there to remind them to let us know when they do want to change something? Absolutely. And, you know, has it happened? Of course it's happened that they've overwritten something. We've had to go back in and tweak it. You know, we have a lot of clients that aren't that educated on digital marketing. And we, our approach is always the approach of wanting to keep them as, you know, long, long-term clients. And so our perspective is always that we do try to treat them respectfully, but also without lying to them. Like, we're always going to let them know if they screwed something up. We're just going to let them know in a respectful manner.
Yeah, 100%. What about scenarios? Because I'd personally, in this case, I'd say it's actually the agency's fault for not explaining things properly in most cases. But what about scenarios where it's, I don't know, 2-3 months into the campaign, not enough time to actually deliver significant level of results, but the client's unhappy about the lack of results so far?
That's interesting.
How should they respond to that?
I mean, look, it will always happen. And ultimately, you know, you're going to have to put in, you're going to have, like, it's going to be impacted by so many different facets, right? So, like, you know, how it was sold, and if it was missold, if stuff was promised, and all of that kind of stuff. In the rare case that SEO was sold correctly, and that everything was done to a T, and it just hasn't, you know, it just hasn't brought it home yet, then, you know, you're going to have to work with some flexibility or decide to drop the client. You know, you have to be super realistic. Like, you're either going to have to do extra work to try and get them there, or you're going to have to explain to them that it will take longer, and then be confident in the fact that it will take longer and that you will achieve something. Or you're going to have to be realistic and say, look, you know, we're going to have to, like, stop working together because I don't think that I can get you the results that that you want in the time period that you want us to achieve them. Now, that is where we start entering the whole debate around sales. And, you know, for us, we only really work with businesses now that have an established internet presence, because we know we can get them results very quickly.
I agree with that. Yeah, I'm the same. I think brand new sites absolutely terrify me. I mean, we do it, and I do it for my own sites, but if I'm going to do it for someone else's and take their money, it is a lot more scary and is a lot more at play. I can't be as confident going into it as if it's a site that's been up and running for years, has a lot of traffic already, has an existing brand already. In that case, it is so much easier.
Yeah, no, 100%. And that's it. Like, you know, you can come into a, you can come into a successful store, for example, right? Like an e-com site, and make some basic CRO optimizations, and within the first month, make them more money. You know,
for sure.
And it's just as simple as that. Or even with a service-based business, you can make the CTAs clearer on day one, really. I mean, you know, I'm over-exaggerating, but within the first 2 weeks, you can make their CTAs clearer and start getting them more leads just from that, just from the existing traffic. And so those are the kind of things that we look out for when we do look at clients, because, man, you're fighting such a losing battle if you start off with clients, especially on a small budget, on a small website. Like, look, if somebody comes to you and they're like, look, we're going to be releasing a SaaS. It's just been VC funded. We're going to get all the press over the next couple of months. We're going to be in the New York Times. We're going to be on TV, all of that. That's a different story. They will also have a decent budget to throw at you, but they're also naturally going to get links and traffic and going to grow quickly. But if it's literally like, hey guys, I'm a roofer, I've got a brand new website, it's got a brand new domain, and we've got no traffic, and I've got $375 a month, run for the hills. Especially when it's from an SEO perspective, you know, maybe you can help them with something else. Maybe you can help them with, I don't know what, ranking their GMB or doing PPC or doing Facebook ads or whatever for them. But I don't think that people should be accepting those kind of SEO clients, just simply because it's just going to lead to tears, basically.
I'm 100% with you there. What are the big mindset differences you've had from the last time I did this interview until today?
Wow. Okay. One of the biggest things is I value my time a lot more. So I've been trying to, like, buy back my own time wherever I can by, you know, delegating and stuff like that. Which, you know, when I first started this, I tried to do literally everything myself. Let me think about that. What else? I really value spending money on in like learning and, you know, it like I said earlier, you know, paying people for their time so that I can either see how they do things or learn from their experiences. I've really like back, you know, the last time we called, if you had told me that I have to spend $250 or something for an hour of someone's time, I would have, you know, run for the hills and crazy. Whereas now I'm like, yeah, all day long. I think one of the other things that I've really learned is just to kind of disconnect myself with a lot of the noise of the industry. I think that back then I was a little bit more naive and I was still trying to hop around too much and trying to get too excited about different things. Whereas now I am a little bit like I've put the, what do you call them that horses have, like the blinkers on, and I'm kind of like just laser focused on what I'm trying to achieve rather than, you know, looking at the thing I'm trying to achieve and 17 other things. So it's a lot better that way.
Awesome, man. I love it. Thank you for joining me again on the show. It's awesome to have you back on again. It's super interesting to see the progress over the past few years for the both of us. And yeah, man, it's really cool to have you here.
Thank you so much, Dara. I really appreciate it. It's been so good catching up and also reliving all of those moments since we last spoke. Amazing.
Absolutely, man. So I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. If you like more content like this, make sure you subscribe on iTunes or wherever the heck this thing is. And besides that, I'll see you guys in the next episode.